So I'm here with James Glick, who's most recently the author of The Information. James, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Pretty well. I wanted to, first of all, start with the hero of your book, Claude Shannon, who, of course, is the history, he's the inventor of the bite. He built on the work, of course, of Charles Babbage. Shannon conducted early experiments in relay switches, creating the differential analyzer. He made very unusual connections between electricity and logic. He observed that when a relay is open, it may cause the next circuit to become open. The same thing holds, of course, when the relays are closed. Years later, Shannon, as you describe, is able to demonstrate that anything that is non-random in a message will allow for compression. I'm curious how Shannon persuaded himself to measure information beyond the telegraph. In 1949, as you produce in the book, there's this really fantastic paper where he draws a line and he starts estimating bit storage capacity. As you point out later in the book, he's actually very close with the measurement of the Library of Congress. How can he or anybody know that he's right about data measurement when, of course, it's all speculative?
Wow. That was a very fast and compressed summary of many of the ideas of Claude Shannon and leading into Claude Shannon.
Yes.
Well, as you're saying, he is the central figure of my book. I'm not sure I would have used the word hero, but he certainly is where he's my starting point. My book starts in a way in the middle of a long story, and that moment is 1948 when Claude Shannon publishes his world-changing paper, A Mathematical Theory of Communication, which then becomes a book, The Mathematical Theory of Communication. And for the first time, he uses the word bit as a unit of measure for this stuff, this somewhat mysterious thing that he's proposing to speak about scientifically for the first time. He would go around saying to people, when I talk about information as an engineer and a mathematician, I'm using the word in a scientific way. It's an old word, and I might not mean what you think I mean. And that's true, because before scientists took over the word, information was just, you know, gossip or news or instructions, nothing especially interesting, and certainly nothing all-encompassing. I guess the point of my book, to the extent that I have a point, is that information is now all-encompassing. It's the fuel that powers the world we live in.
Yes.
And that begins, in a way, with Claude Shannon. Although, as I say, that's the middle of the story.
Got it. Well, as you point out, also information overload or information anxiety, this has been a truism as long as we've had information. You bring up both T.S. Eliot's The Rock, where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? And of course, a prescient 1982 Computer World article warning that email can cause severe information overload problems. To what degree did Shannon's data measurements account for the possibility of overload? I didn't quite get that from your book, and I was always very curious. I mean, there is no end to that line on the paper.
No, Shannon wasn't, Shannon didn't really predict the world that we live in now. And it wasn't just that he was measuring data, it's that he was creating an entire mathematical framework for solving a whole lot of problems having to do with the transmission of information, the storage of information, the compression of information, as you mentioned. He was, after all, working for the telephone company.
Yeah.
He was working for Bell Labs, which had a lot of money at stake in solving problems of efficiently sending information over analog copper telephone wires. But Shannon, in creating his mathematical framework, did it simultaneously for the analog problem and the digital problem, because he was looking ahead. As you also mentioned in your very compressed run-up, he thought very early about relays and electrical circuits. And a relay is a binary thing. It's open or closed. And he realized that open or closed was the same as not just on or off, but yes or no, and true or false. You could apply electrical circuits to logic. and particularly to the symbolic logic invented by George Boole in the 19th century. So Shannon created his mathematical theory of communication, which was both analog and digital. And where it was digital, it had, we can see now, with the advantage of hindsight, perfect suitability to the world of computers that was then in the process of being born.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me, though, that he could see the possibilities of endless relay loops, but not consider that perhaps there is a threshold as to the load that of information that one can handle. I mean, there was nothing that he did to sort of say, well, wait a minute, maybe there's a limit to all of this.
I'm not sure that was really his department.
Okay.
I don't think you can either particularly fault him for that or give him credit. One way or the other. It wasn't...
It just didn't occur to him?
No, it's not that it didn't occur to him. It's that, well, I would say, and I do say in the book, that this issue, I'm hesitating to call it problem, of information overload, of information glut, is not as new a thing as we like to think.
Yeah.
Of course, the words are new. Information glut, information overload, information fatigue.
Information anxiety.
Information anxiety, that's right. These are all expressions of our time.
There's also information sickness as well. That's a good one.
Yeah. But one of the little fun side paths that I took in the book was to look back through history at previous complaints about what we now call information overload, and they go back as far as you're willing to look. As soon as the printing press started flooding Europe with printed books, there were lots of people who were complaining that this was going to be the end of human knowledge as we knew it, that Leibniz was one, Jonathan Swift was another, Alexander Pope. They all complained about, well, in Leibniz's words, the horrible mass of books. He thought it threatened a return to barbarity. Why? Because it was now no longer possible for any person, no matter how well-educated, no matter how philosophical, to keep up with all human knowledge. There were just too many books. There were 1,000 or 10,000 in the entire world. Well, now there are 10,000 books printed every hour in the world. I mean, individual titles.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we worry about information overload, and yes, you can say that Claude Shannon, in solving these problems, greased the skids. But I don't know whether it's true or not that he didn't foresee the issue. It just was an issue that wasn't in his bailiwick.
Got it. I wanted to shift over to Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, one of Charles Babbage's great supporters. You bring up the moment in which she becomes obsessed with a puzzle called solitaire. She writes Babbage in 1840 asking if it is possible to solve the puzzle through a mathematical formula. You quote this letter and write that the very idea of a formal solution to a game was original, but what of, say, James Waldegrave's letter in 1713 proposing, you know, a mathematical formula to the card game of Le Herre? I mean, Waldegrave's letter, that's one of the early aspects of game theory. What distinguishes Lovelace's letter from Waldegrave's?
I don't know anything about Waldegrave.
Oh.
So you're catching me by surprise. I'll tell you about Ada Byron, though.
Sure.
As you say, she was the poet's daughter. And by virtue of being the poet's daughter, she was sort of famous. I mean, to the extent that anybody was famous in Victorian England. They didn't have People magazine. But if they had had People magazine, she would have been a natural.
Yeah.
Because she was rich and she was beautiful and she was the poet's daughter. But she grew up in a kind of sad kind of isolation in her mother's household. Her father had left England, never to return, when she was 1 year old. She never knew Byron. She didn't even know until she was 8 or 10 who her father was. She had a fantastic mathematical aptitude. And because she was rich, and because her mother was pretty smart too, her mother brought in tutors to help her learn some mathematics. That was That was where she was lucky. She was lucky in being rich. She was unlucky in being female.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't attend university. She couldn't join any professional society, with the exception, I think, of the Horticultural Society in England. She couldn't publish papers under her name. She had no outlet for formal work in mathematics. But she did get to know Babbage, who was a generation older than she was. Babbage, as many of our listeners will know, was working on a giant mechanical calculating machine that he called the difference engine. And it was briefly a very famous project, and he succeeded in attracting funding from the government of England, but he never succeeded in completing it because he was too ambitious. His idea that he exceeded the state of the art in what was possible in machinery and machine tools in those days. But he had a model of a piece of the calculating machine on display in his house in London, and he threw these parties in the evening, and young Ada Byron came to one of these parties, and unlike most of his visitors, she actually understood what he was up to. And he recognized that she understood it, and they talked, and they started working together on his idea for the next iteration of the machine, which was more than just a calculating machine. It was something like a computer. It had separate areas for storing numbers, as he thought, information, as we would now say, and for processing them. These are modern words that he didn't use. Now, you mentioned this game of solitaire. That was just one of the many sort of problems that you see Ada Byron working on. You see them in her letters. And it was a game of pegs.
Yes, much different from what we see with cards or even on our Windows operating systems. Yeah,
but actually, there are modern versions of it. You can buy it at a game store. It's got how many pegs around a circle, and the pegs hop over each other, and the object of the game is to end up with just one remaining peg. And she not only solved the problem, but because she was thinking in terms of this giant calculating machine, she put it to Babbage that maybe this is the sort of thing that a giant calculating machine could work on, that maybe the problem could be mathematicized, that maybe a symbolic language could be created in which the solution to puzzles of this kind could be written, could be accomplished. And that maybe his machine would be suitable not only for computing with numbers, but also computing in a more general way with information, such as solving this puzzle. This was a puzzle. It was just a puzzle of pegs, you know, it was in the physical world. So as Babbage was with a machine that was connecting metal to numbers, the material world to the abstract world, she too was connecting this game of pegs to a level of abstraction that could have been written down on paper, a symbolic language, and then to a further level of abstraction that could be manipulated in machinery. Now, all of this, you know, you're nodding. We're all nodding because we're living in a world of computers where this is second nature to us. The idea of machines playing games, of a symbolic language for all sorts of things besides just numbers, all of that is second nature to us. But it's useful as an intellectual exercise to subtract from what we know all of this stuff, because it wasn't always known. And to understand how it was discovered, you need to put yourself back in the mindset of people for whom it was not known.
I also wanted to ask about Norbert Wiener. He entered into the information debate with cybernetics. Of course, he started off by patronizing Claude Shannon and appropriating the term feedback from electrical engineering. He offered the idea of feedback as his answer to entropy, which we haven't managed to get into yet. You write that Wiener's best-selling book, Cybernetics, is a hodgepodge of notions and analysis. Cybernetics, eventually did fall out of favor. There was a bit of a spurt in the 70s, largely through biology. I'm wondering, were any of Wiener's contributions to information theory especially original, or was he more one of those figures who tends to popularize a notion to, I suppose, get the wheels spinning, so to speak?
No, Wiener was a giant, and you're making me sound much more hostile to him than I intended to sound. Maybe I did use the word hodgepodge, and his book, Cybernetics, is kind of a funny book. It has a whole assortment of ideas, and some of them are very mathematical, astonishingly mathematical, considering that this was a bestseller in the 1950s. He was on the cover of Time magazine and Life magazine. Wiener was a genius. He was, in terms of his personality, maybe arrogant. He and Shannon, if you read between the lines, as I try to do in the book, exhibit a certain amount of tension toward one another. They review each other's books politely, but maybe there's a level of faint praise there. In many ways, Wiener was certainly an original. Even if he borrowed ideas from other places, so did Shannon, so does everyone. He was very original and very ambitious in combining the ideas of communication and control. That's what he said cybernetics was. He invented that word, a science of communication and control. He, as you say, employed notions of feedback and notions of entropy to understand information. He didn't speak as directly about information as Shannon did. Yeah. That's one of the differences between their methods. Another difference was that Shannon was mathematically more rigorous than Wiener was, so that in decades to come, when other mathematicians picked up on information theory and extended it into other realms, such as physics, it was Shannon's work that they found most useful, not Wiener's. Shannon really had laid out a very sound and broad mathematical framework. Nonetheless, I'm attracted to Wiener's ideas for several reasons. And one of them was, he was thinking very much about us humans. He was thinking about biological issues. He thought about mechanical prostheses and problems of vision and problems of mental health and how ideas of information and or feedback could be used not just to solve those problems, but to help people. He was very interesting and is still very much worth reading.
Yeah, so he wasn't really a Solieri type to poor Shannon or anything?
No, not at all. There was a little bit of tension between them, but they also worked together. And one of the interesting episodes of my book is after the formal birth of information theory, there was a time when the ideas were starting to spread through various communities. And Norbert Wiener was responsible for organizing a bunch of interdisciplinary conferences, mostly in New York at the Beekman Hotel, that came to be called cybernetics conferences after his work, but had not just mathematicians like Shannon, but John von Neumann, the physicist and mathematician, and Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, and a bunch of very interesting psychologists and social scientists, all thrown together in the same room, and all trying to talk about these ideas in an interdisciplinary way. I give Wiener credit for bringing these people together and for seeing, in a grand way, the possibilities of these new ideas.
Mm-hmm. I also wanted to go back to Ada Lovelace, and I did ask you a question about whether she was really the original person to propose a mathematical formula with which to solve a game. I'm wondering if you found other figures similar to the one I had mentioned, James Waldegrave. Was she just there simply because she's in close proximity to Babbage, or why did you write she was the original?
I'm not sure what you're getting at exactly, because I'm not familiar with the older mathematician
Got it.
you're mentioning. And I'm not sure exactly what kind of claim you think I'm making on her behalf.
Well, certainly there were other figures who were proposing mathematical formulas to games.
Well,
to
a mathematical formula to solve a game is, that's a small thing.
Yeah.
I mentioned that in passing.
Yeah.
Regarding this game of solitaire. That's not her contribution. Let me see if I can explain it this way. First of all, I'm talking about a piece of work that was not published under her name.
Yeah.
It was published with her initials, AAL. Her married name was Loveless. It was a sort of appendix in seven parts to a translation from Italian of a popular explanation by the mathematician Menabrea of Babbage's work on his analytical engine. Wow, that was a very long, complicated sentence.
They're welcome, dear.
Babbage designed and planned the next generation of his calculating machine, as I've said. And it was, as I've said, in retrospect, a kind of computer. It was a computer that was never built. It could never have been built. He was just too ambitious. I mean, it existed in his head. Because it existed in his head, only a few people really knew about it and understood it, and one of them was Ada. Ada worked with Babbage on trying to solve a bunch of specific problems, mathematical problems. Some of them were very complicated and difficult that she and Babbage both felt could be solved theoretically with this non-existent machine. So imagine the problem. They're trying to do a kind of computer programming. They're trying to write computer programs that will do very advanced mathematics. We're not talking about calculating numbers. We're talking about finding solutions to Bernoulli equations. And they're trying to do it without a machine to actually work on. Not only is there no programming language, there's no possibility of a programming language because there's no actual hardware. So it's all in their heads. In retrospect, because we can read Ada's work, we can see what a genius she was. She solved fantastically difficult problems of programming, computer programming, that were more than a century ahead of her time. Furthermore, she was ahead of Babbage himself in one important respect, and that's this. Babbage never stopped thinking about his machines as a way of manipulating numbers. Ada had a wider vision, and it's a very modern vision by our lights. She was thinking, and she said, if the information that you can move from place to place in this complicated imaginary machine, from memory to the processing unit, can be numbers, it could also be other things. It could be music. These numbers could stand for things. It could be words. It could be symbols. And that was just, again, the kind of thing that we take for granted now, that information encompasses all of those things. But that was a new thought, and it was new with Ada Byron. So I believe she's absolutely entitled to the title that many people have given her in our era of the first computer programmer.
Sufficient clarity with that answer. Let's talk about entropy, which we were discussing a little bit before, and the second law of thermodynamics. The second law states that entropy, that energy which is not used for useful work, either increases or stays constant. But James Clerk Mark Maxwell comes along and he sees disorder as entropy's essential quality. You cite Maxwell writing, "Confusion, like the correlative term order, is not a proper of material things in themselves, but only in relation to the mind which perceives them. But if dissipated energy is, in the case of information, purely a matter of perception, I'm curious, why do entropic algorithms, as introduced by Cole Mulgrof, which you have later on in the book, provide this missing link, so to speak, between the material and the perceived, an answer to Maxwell's ideas about these essential components of entropy.
Can you rephrase the question?
Well, I think I'm trying to get at a connection between Maxwell saying that, you know, confusion is not a property of material things in themselves, but only in relation to the mind which perceives it. And then you have a situation where Cole Mulgrof comes later and he offers these algorithms, and then all of a sudden, the algorithms provide that link between what he's talking about earlier in terms of the mind perceiving something along the lines of disorder versus what's actually material. And so I'm trying to determine how that became just something more applicable to science, the link between the material and the perceived.
Well, it's a complicated question.
Yeah.
And one could write a book. I'm trying to think about the best way to go about addressing it. I mean, you're bringing together some fairly widely separated elements of my book. One of them has to do with the origins of the idea of entropy at the time of Maxwell and others who were creating a science of thermodynamics, which was, of course, a science of steam engines.
Yes.
That was the technology that they needed to explain, and they needed to understand the physics of heat. And they came up with this very difficult concept of entropy that I'm not going to try to explain right now. The reason I'm not going to try to explain it is it's too hard. And I'll tell you the following story about that. Well, you know it. You know the story because it's in my book. When Claude Shannon adopted the term entropy as a part of his information theory, there was a rumor that went around Bell Labs, and the rumor was that it was von Neumann who had told Shannon he should use the word entropy, and he had said use that because if you say entropy, no one will know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's hard. The point that I tried to make that I think you're picking up on is that in thermodynamical systems, entropy was a kind of measure of disorder. That's why it's interesting to us now. That's why it was interesting to Claude Shannon, and it appeared in information theory, because Shannon and Kolmogorov, who you also mentioned in your question, were trying to understand the degree of randomness in a message, or the degree of disorder in a message being a string of symbols. And Shannon recognized, and Kolmogorov proved it mathematically 10 years later, that there was a deep connection between the measure of information, the number of bits in a message, and the amount of randomness in it, the amount of disorder in it. And the connection expressed mathematically happened to resemble the mathematical expression that physicists had come up with for entropy when they were studying thermodynamics.
Got it.
Was that a coincidence? No. It looked like it, almost. It looked like a mathematical oddity, that the equations were the same. But it wasn't. And the reason it wasn't a coincidence is that when you were talking about heat also, you were thinking about disorder, and here the disorder was a molecular disorder. You might be thinking about a box of gas and the molecules in the gas, and the more orderly they were, the less entropy there was. The difficult thing, and this is the point that you have singled out in the beginning of your question, is that the very idea of disorder, disorganization, doesn't seem or didn't seem in the 1800s like something that a physicist ought to be worrying about. Maxwell was thinking about energy. He was thinking about molecules. He was thinking about physical forces. But order and disorder seemed to be abstract ideas that didn't have anything to do with physics.
Yeah.
So he was quite rightly a little puzzled by that, and he called our attention to the problem. And the problem was, in a way, not solved until the time of the information theorists, a century later.
Got it. I'm curious about useless or extraneous information, information that is replaced. I was actually surprised that you didn't bring up Thomas Kuhn's notion of a paradigm shift. That's not mentioned in the book. You do bring up Richard Dawkins, his famous defense of dyslexia as a sort of selfish genetic quality that accounts for a genetic aspect before humans learned how to read. And I'm wondering, though, how a paradigm shift in which new science replaces the old has value to information theory, or if you pursued this at any point during your research for this book.
You know, honestly, I think the expression paradigm shift has become a bit of a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my first book, Chaos, I did write quite a bit about Thomas Kuhn and about paradigm shifts. And at the time, it seemed very relevant to me there. Since then, I have a feeling that the word is applied almost any time something new happens in science. And so I didn't want to go down that road this time. If you're asking me, do I think that the development of information theory qualifies as a paradigm shift in that sense? I'll punt and say, I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it does. I mean, it's not a silly notion. It's just maybe I feel it's a little bit overused.
What about Claude Shannon and his notions of extraneous information? I mean, you bring up several times in the book the idea of the English language having all of these extraneous characters.
Not extraneous, but redundant.
Redundant, yeah.
Yeah. Well, redundancy is a feature of ordinary language, and we all know that. Or maybe we don't. Maybe we needed Shannon to remind us. But before Shannon knew it, code breakers knew it. When I say redundancy, what I mean is there are things in a message that don't absolutely have to be there. And if you're a computer engineer trying to compress the message for efficient storage on your hard disk, you can leave them out, especially if you have a reliable mathematical algorithm that enables you to recover them. Simple example. When I was growing up in New York City, there were posters on buses, advertising posters, that would say, if you can read this message, but if was spelled F,
yeah.
U was spelled U, can was spelled C-N, it was F, U, C-N, R-D, T-H-S, MSG. And yet you could read that message. You could fill in the missing letters just from your knowledge of English. And so you might say that those missing vowels or the other missing letters aren't totally necessary. They're redundant. They're extraneous. And there's a way to measure that, it turns out. And that's what Claude Shannon did in part of the run-up to creating information theory. He tried to make precise measurements of the degree of redundancy in a natural language like English. And it turns out it is possible to do that. It's complicated, though, because it turns out that you have to find every correlation. In ordinary English, the letter U, when it appears after the letter Q, is almost always redundant because Q almost always is followed by the letter U, you know, 99% of the time. The letters TH often go together, not as often as the letters Q and U, but they go together a lot, and you can, if you've got a computer and you set it to work on a bunch of text, with which Claude Shannon did not have, you can measure that, you can compute it. And if you're a computer engineer designing an algorithm to compress text, knowing those statistical frequencies is very important. On the other hand, there are a lot of correlations that have to do with the meaning of the text, and they're just as real. For example, if you've got a message of 1,000 words, and somewhere near the beginning of the message the word cow appears, statistically, it's much more likely that the word cow is going to appear again near the end of the message than it would in a random message of 1,000 words. And not only that, it's more likely that the word horse is going to appear in the message. And so to be really efficient in measuring the amount of randomness in the message or compressing the message, you really need to have a full understanding of the semantic content of the language.
Mm-hmm.
That turns out to be a very difficult problem.
I wanted to bring up Gödel and his incompleteness theorem, which comes along in response to Bertrand Russell and what he set down with the liar's paradox. I want to bring it up in a sort of a slightly different way. You have Gregory Shatton appear in this book. He's investigating randomness, and he concludes that complexity, when defined by program size, is generally uncomputable. Shatton actually comes very close to meeting Gödel because they need to work out some information theory-based form of incompleteness, and Gödel unfortunately dies before they can meet. But this does bring up a very tricky notion. How can anybody measure data, something in a system that is proven to be incomplete, whether it's through the liar's paradox or Berry's paradox? Gödel says, hey, you can use any paradox you want. How can you measure something if it will be revealed to be incomplete, the entire system?
Gödel did prove that any mathematical system that is consistent must be incomplete, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Any mathematical system, any system of formal axioms that's complete, has to have some inconsistency in it. This is a great philosophical discovery that undermined the foundations of logic in the 20th century. But it hasn't brought us all to a halt. We still use logic. We still use mathematics. And in fact, Greg Chaitin pointed out that really most mathematicians for a long time didn't pay much attention to Kurt Gödel because his logical discoveries didn't in any way affect their ability to go on doing their work. And that's fine. And so...
And he was dissed by Wittgenstein as well.
Sure. There were lots of people who didn't understand him very well. It doesn't really matter. Gödel comes back into the story because... not because he makes it difficult for mathematicians to do their work or because he undermines our faith in their discoveries, but because, in a way, his work was essential in understanding computers, in creating computers. Claude Shannon relied on Gödel's thinking indirectly by way of Alan Turing, and so does Gregory Chaitin, who has developed Claude Shannon's work and created what he calls algorithmic information theory. All of these intellectual pieces form one giant puzzle.
Yeah. In your chapter on Wikipedia, you quote Pierre-Simon Laplace's line about an intelligence capable of perfect knowledge. It would embrace, in the same formula, the movements of the greatest bodies of the universe and those of the lightest atom. For it, nothing would be uncertain, and the future, as the past, would be present to its eyes. This may very well have inspired scientists, thinkers, intellectuals, and the like, leading to the idea of the universe being nothing less than a vast computer. Turing, who you just mentioned, wished to confine this ideal to computers, but with so many revert wars and battles between deletionists and exclusionists on Wikipedia, is Turing right to some degree? I mean, to bring Dawkins back into this on Wikipedia, are we not the ultimate vessels for selfish genes wishing to spread our own information against this Babel-like tower of cranks and enthusiasts? Or?
Well, again, you're throwing three different names and ideas into one complicated question, so I'm not exactly sure where to start. Laplace's idea was a famous old idea. It was kind of Newtonianism taken to an extreme. His idea was that if the laws of physics are completely determined and the motion of every particle in the universe depends on the motions of the particles that affected it before, then God, or a perfect intelligence with complete knowledge of the positions and velocities of all the particles in the universe, ought to be able to compute its destiny. In other words, there's no such thing as free will.
Yeah.
So that was a problem. People didn't particularly like that idea or believe in it, but it seemed inevitable if you took Newtonianism to its perfect extreme. Well, in our time, we know that there are a lot of reasons that Newtonianism doesn't work that perfectly throughout the universe. That is, there are all sorts of discoveries that undermine it. One is the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics. You can't know the position and the velocity of every subatomic particle, or of any subatomic particle, with perfect accuracy. Another is chaos, which is the subject of a whole other book that we won't talk about now. The fact that there's no such thing as perfect knowledge doesn't need to interfere with our desire to learn as much as we can. And maybe this is where we come back to Wikipedia, which is the enterprise of cyberspace that more than any other is trying to assemble a kind of complete record of human knowledge. Not everything that's ever been written, but the most perfect and broadest possible encyclopedia. And yes, as you say, they have edit wars, because it turns out that we don't agree on everything. We're individuals and we have differences of opinion. And maybe, and this is not an analogy that I want you to take literally the way a physicist would, just as one cannot know the position and velocity of every individual particle in the universe, we can't know the state of our own minds. And we can't know whose version of the truth is the correct one.
So it creates a difficult prospect if we're talking about the totality of information or the possibility of perfect knowledge.
Well, it's only difficult if that's what you were dreaming of. I've never dreamed of that myself. I've never thought one day we'll know everything.
Okay. Well, on that note, James, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Well, thank you. The pleasure was mine.
Great.
Informer. You know, say that I'm a stormy, I go blame. I like it, boom, boom, damn. Take the man that says that I'm a stormy, stab somebody down the lane. I like it, boom, boom, damn. Informer. You know, say that I'm a stormy, I go blame. I like it, boom, boom, damn. Take the man that says that I'm a stormy, stab somebody down the lane. I like it, boom, boom, damn.